The Morning Show. The Home Team. No, it's both. It's The Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brame.
Crossover, step back!
That's a buzzer! Right here on 960theref.com.
All right, 960 The Ref listeners, we've reached a monumental milestone here on The Crossover. Episode 20.
Wow, we've been at this 20 times now.
I know, it doesn't seem like it's been that many, but yeah, Sam Franco, Chris Brame along with you, 960theref.com. It is The Crossover Podcast. You can always find it on 960theref.com, facebook.com/960theref, and Twitter at 960theref. But you should also subscribe on iTunes. Makes it much easier. It just downloads right into whatever podcast receptacle you have, whether it be a computer, an iPhone, iPad, any of those things. Just makes it much easier. This is 2017.
Yeah. I got an iPhone and I got my Purple podcast app.
Perfect.
That's how I work it.
Those two things work out perfectly. So we've got plenty to dive into today. We'll talk a lot of Georgia as they go to Notre Dame, get that win. We'll talk Falcons as they also picked up a win in the Midwest this week. But I have to start first and foremost by giving myself a lot of credit, because on this podcast last week, I very confidently stated that Oklahoma would go into the Shoe and get a win, and that was a butt kicking.
It was, and yeah, I didn't think that would happen. I didn't think Urban Meyer would lose a home game to a first year coach coaching in his second career game. I did, I did think Ohio State should be troubled by the fact that they allowed 400 yards passing to Indiana's quarterback with Baker Mayfield on deck. But you know, in the end, I still felt like Ohio State would pull that out, but Baker Mayfield was the difference in that game. Not sure he needed to apologize for planting the flag at midfield like he did. Seems like teams have been doing stuff like that for a while, and I kind of feel like Ohio State might have gone to midfield last year when they won at Norman and maybe not plant a flag or anything, but I'm pretty sure they danced or had some kind of a team meeting. But great win for Oklahoma. I mean, what a turn for their fan base. You think in June you find out, you know, kind of abruptly that your legendary coach is retiring and turning it over to to someone who's really kind of green. It wasn't that long ago that Lincoln Riley was just the offensive coordinator at East Carolina, and 2 weeks into the season they're winning at Ohio State. And you know, Oklahoma now, that's a great, great win if they can hang on, and long way to go. Win the Big 12, though. That's going to be a good resume booster for them to help their playoff cause.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, they have the Big 12 title game now, but yeah, I mean, that win is absolutely huge for them going forward. So Ohio State can still rebound from it, but they have a lot of problems. That pass defense is the worst in the country through the first 2 weeks of the season, and they've also got a quarterback that isn't really playing that well. I mean, he played well in the second half against Indiana, but, you know, for a game and a half, he has not been great.
No, and now Ohio State's in that predicament that, you know, oftentimes schools with struggling starting quarterbacks will find themselves in, that the backup quarterback's the most popular guy on campus, and they've got, you know, a former five-star recruit who's a redshirt there that now people are kind of jonesing to see. Get in there and see what happens. But you're right. I mean, Ohio State a couple of years ago lost at home to Virginia Tech, which I'm going to guess that Oklahoma's not going to end up going like 6-6, which I think that Virginia Tech team did. I mean, that was a bad, bad loss for the Buckeyes, and they ended up running the table and ended up getting in the playoff and winning the national championship. So, yeah, it's far from over for Ohio State. They're still going to be more talented than every team they face for the rest of the year, including Penn State and Michigan. But, yeah, they've got they got problems in their secondary, and you're right, Barrett he's not looked good.
No, he has not. So that's enough about Ohio State and Oklahoma. I just wanted to pat myself on the back, as you can hear right there. But we got to dive into this Georgia game. It was a great weekend for Dog Nation, whether it was in Chicago or Indianapolis or South Bend. I mean, Georgia took over. It started on Friday night. Or actually, I think it started on Thursday night when a bunch of Georgia fans invaded Brian Kelly's radio show and called the Dogs while he was on air in South Bend for his radio show.
Yeah, he should have known it was going to be a long weekend at that point.
For sure, but that happened. And then Friday at the Cubs game, Vince Dooley throws out the first pitch. The Dogs are called at Wrigley Field, which is one of the coolest experiences I've ever been a part of. It was really awesome to be in there for that. There was a lot of Cubs fans that were whining and moaning and bitching about it. They were like, we're in the middle of a playoff race. This is disrespectful, blah, blah, blah.
And they lost that game, right?
They did lose 2-0. It was off of a Ryan Braun just bomb of a home run.
Did he hit it out on Waverly?
He hit it straight center field.
Okay.
Yeah, so that thing was a bomb. But Wrigley Field was really cool. It was really awesome to walk around there and see all that and just be a part of that and just see Georgia fans everywhere. So Chicago was painted red. There's no question about that. And then Saturday, people got on their buses or rent-a-cars or whatever, made their way to South Bend. And even before the game, Notre Dame fans were extremely hospitable. Like, Georgia fans know this going to different SEC tailgates, whether it's, I guess we don't go to Gainesville, but you're talking about Tennessee and LSU and Alabama and all that stuff, and nowhere near as hospitable. But Notre Dame fans welcomed Georgia fans with open arms, and they also welcomed them into their stadium with open arms and open wallets.
Well, I mean, with what Georgia fans were willing to pay for a ticket, if I was a Notre Dame fan and my team had been 4-8 the year before, I probably would have said, you're willing to give me $1,500 for this seat? Okay.
Do you think a part of it, though, was maybe a protest on Brian Kelly from the Notre Dame fans where they were like, hey, we don't mind not going to this game? Because when I walked in that stadium, Notre Dame's press box had this little deck off to the side where you could like go outside and kind of look around. And the entire one end zone was red. I'm talking like this was like an hour before the game. This packed with red. And I'm like, there may be more Georgia fans. Like, we knew there were going to be a lot of Georgia fans making the trip. We just didn't know how many were to be in the stadium. There were a lot more Georgia fans in that stadium. I mean, it was about as close to 50-50 as you could possibly get for a true road game.
Yeah, I mean, with the visual I saw on television, I mean, I would say but there had to have been good somewhere between 30, 35,000 Georgia fans.
I mean, it looked like the game in Jacksonville. Like, when you go in half the stadium, it's, like, split right down the middle. That's kind of what it looked like.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, definitely just a Brian Kelly thing, but I think it certainly is. Notre Dame was 4-8 last year.
Yeah.
And, I mean, Notre Dame fans are definitely not happy, and the result Saturday night and in the aftermath of that when he got a little testy in his post-game press conference certainly isn't going to help things out. But, yeah, I mean, if this was like the 80s, and Georgia wanted to go down there and buy tickets, maybe Notre Dame fans wouldn't have been so quick to give them up. But, I mean, the price that Georgia fans are willing to pay, I know if I was a Notre Dame fan holding a ticket and somebody was like, okay, yes, you want to give me $1,500 for this? I'll sit at home and watch it on NBC.
Yeah, no question about that. But overall, it was a great, great experience for Georgia fans. If you were able to make the trip, it's one that you'll remember for the rest of your life. And really just the fact that Georgia turned Notre Dame Stadium essentially into Vanderbilt Stadium for that kind of home field advantage, or at least neutral site you almost get when you go on the road in the SEC, that won't happen at any SEC venue, and it certainly won't happen when Notre Dame comes to Georgia in 2019.
No, absolutely not. And, I mean, I don't, you know, to be fair, I guess, to the Notre Dame fans, I mean, as much as we love Athens, I don't know that other college football fans would consider Athens, Georgia's like this bucket list
spot.
Well,
right, not like South Bend is.
Right. Yeah. I mean, South Bend's got the, you know, it's got the history and the mystique about it and the Gold Dome and Touchdown Jesus that not just Georgia fans, but, you know, any fan of a college team that doesn't go out there regularly is going to want to go and experience. But, yeah, I mean, it was a terrific showing, and it was great that Georgia rewarded all the fans with what was a thrilling game and a win ultimately. And, I mean, definitely that couldn't have hurt Georgia in recruiting.
No.
With any prospects sitting out there and realizing how
the fan base traveled like that.
Yeah, I mean, and how into it that Georgia fans can get.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. So we'll dive into the game now. And first and foremost, the Georgia defense was unbelievable. I mean, you look at the play of Roquan Smith, of Davin Bellamy, of Lorenzo Carter, J.R. Reed. I mean, the whole defense played well, but those are just the guys that were, like, playing out of their mind. And this is exactly what you wanted if you were a Georgia fan. Or if you were Georgia going into this game. I mean, Brandon Wimbush did attempt 16 rushes, according to the stats. He only had 1 yard. None of the running backs had more yards on any attempt than Wimbush. Wimbush's long was 8. Adams had a run of 7, and Book had a rush of 2. He only had 1 attempt, and it was for 2 yards. But You had Josh Adams, who was very good against against Temple, 19 carries for 53 yards. I mean, Georgia's defense did a great job of not only controlling Notre Dame's running attack, but making Brandon Wimbush throw the ball 40 times. If you had told me before the game that Wimbush was going to throw the ball 40 times, I would have told you that's a great sign for Georgia.
Well, I mean, Georgia's defense did a good job of keeping him in the pocket, containing him, not letting him get out, and
Roquan
and
spied him about as well as like anything you could see,
right?
Or could have wished for.
And I mean, that was one of my bigger concerns going into last week's game, because the biggest plays Appalachian State had were those Taylor Lamb runs. So, you know, it's something that we've seen Georgia's defense is susceptible to. It's something that we saw when Kirby was the defensive coordinator at Alabama. The types of quarterbacks that would get to their defense were those mobile quarterbacks that could get out there and run. And so Georgia's defense was fantastic in limiting that. And, I mean, you said it right there. A team that in week one had three 100-yard rushers, their longest run of the game was 8 yards. So not even a big play in that running game at all. And the Dogs' defense is just phenomenal. It's got, I mean, Lorenzo Carter.
Whew.
That's a guy that, since that freshman year at Kentucky, you know, he hasn't lived up to that since. And I was just I'm tired of talking about him in the offseason. As, you know, when I see it again, I'll believe it. And finally, Saturday night, we saw it again. And hopefully that's not something that's just going to be a one game or a one hit thing, that's going to be what he does for the rest of the year now.
Yeah, forced the fumble, recovered two. And on the fumble that he forced, and he just scoops the ball up with one hand, all in kind of like, you know, one motion almost.
It looked like that play Clowney had in that bowl game against Michigan when
he leveled
that running back and then just all in one move, leveled the guy and then
scooped the ball.
Same thing.
And then he was able to recover the fumble on Bellamy's hit, which that was one of the more brutal sacks I think I've seen in a long time, especially because Wimbush didn't see it coming. I mean, he smacked him right in the back, forces the ball out, and that won the game for Georgia, obviously. It was a huge play. And just the fact that Georgia's defense did not let them do anything. I know they only had three sacks, but it felt like a lot more.
Well, yeah, and also on that Bellamy play, it was their star left tackle, McGlinchey, blew right by.
I mean, and that's a guy that's supposed to be like a top 10 pick or like a first-round graded left tackle, and he just got completely obliterated on that play.
You think about how many times we've watched the NFL draft over the last couple of years, and a guy from you know, Florida, Tennessee, these guys will get drafted in the first round and they'll show their little highlight package. And it's like, all right, change the channel because you're about to see Georgia on there a lot. If McGlinchey ends up being a first rounder,
you're going to see Bellamy.
Well, I mean, maybe we won't see that because it's like, yeah, this is a play you don't want to see.
Yeah, that's true.
If they do show it and say, like, well, here's one problem McGlinchey might have.
Well, when Bellamy gets drafted, you'll definitely see that play.
Yeah. Here's Bellamy blowing past, you know, first rounder Mike McGlinchey.
So the defense, I mean, you can't speak enough about how well the defense played. I even thought that the secondary played well. And that's probably the most questioned part, not just of the defense, but probably of Georgia's team. You know, that's the area where Georgia fans have questioned the most, maybe the wide receiver position as well. But certainly I'm not going to say a maligned secondary, but one that did have some question marks about it, and I thought they played pretty well.
Well, and also remember Saturday night, I mean, Aaron Davis was not 100%. Mm-hmm. He'd been dealing with that hamstring injury. Malcolm Parrish didn't even
still
play.
Still don't have Parrish, right.
I mean, that was one of my bigger worries, was the size of their receivers. And
J.R. Reed wishes he would have been able to hold on to that interception, I'm sure.
But there's, you know, for the second year in a row, Georgia's striking gold with a transfer. It was Maurice Smith last year. This year it's J.R. Reed. And so Kirby's done a good job of finding those guys that have come in and been solid contributors defensively.
Well, that's what you've got to do. You know, you've got to pinpoint areas that you need help in. And if you're going to use the transfer rule, then, you know, that's one way to do it.
Sure. But the offense needs to still get its act together.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to jump to now. The offensive line probably not opening as big a hole as the running backs would like. Nick Chubb still ran for 63 yards on 13 carries. Sony Michel, 73 yards on 13 carries. The biggest run of the game, and quite frankly, the biggest play on offense that wasn't a touchdown, was the 40-yard run that set up Sony Michel's touchdown by DeAndre Swift. I mean, if that play doesn't happen, Georgia doesn't win this game.
No, there was another third-down run that Michel had, too, where it looked like, I mean, Notre Dame had gotten into the backfield there, and there were like two or three guys. It looked like they had a chance to get him, and then he just made some little, like,
those ridiculous cuts.
Yeah, I mean, some ridiculous little jump step move and then shot up and was able to get to the first down marker. Otherwise, that's the spot Georgia would have had to punt. But, I mean, there was the entire first possession. Georgia had the ball. And think about this. I mean, what do you get? You get somewhere between 10 and 12 possessions a game, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Chubb and Michelle didn't even handle the ball in the first possession. I think Chubb went an entire quarter without getting the ball, too. And it just Chubb and Michelle need to be way more involved than they were Saturday night. We don't need to see the wildcat run anymore.
That wild dog thing needs to go the way of old Yeller. Like, never put that thing out the pasture and never run it
right
again.
I mean, if you do run it, you have to take the quarterback out of the game.
Well, and there's no threat to run the ball from it from Georgia. I mean, there's no threat to throw the ball from it from Georgia's perspective. And that's when that play works, when there's maybe something that tells the defense, hey, we got to kind of play it a little bit differently, because what if they throw the ball here? But Georgia, there's no threat to throw it.
No. Well, yeah, the advantage that you get there is by, having a guy out wide that they have to cover. And then, right, the line of scrimmage, then you've got that additional man to block, and that's where it's the numbers game. But when all you do is split Fromm out wide, if you notice, they didn't even cover him.
No.
I mean, really, if they wanted to throw it to Fromm, he was standing there wide open. But considering that there's currently no backup quarterback,
you're not going to throw it.
Throw a pass to Jake Fromm at your own peril at this point. But, yeah, that needs to be either get rid of it, or if you want to continue to run it, you have to have somebody other than your quarterback go out wide, somebody that the defense actually does have to go out there and guard. But, I mean, to me, it's just still more. We need more Chubb and Michelle than we saw Saturday night.
And even DeAndre Swift, because Kirby said after the game, Seven's got to get the ball more, too.
No, so, yeah, I mean, I'm all for that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just about using the running game more to help Jake Fromm out, because Fromm looked like a freshman making his first start in this game. I mean, he had a good pass to Terry Godwin, who makes one of the greatest catches I've ever seen. If you watch that catch over and put that thing in slow-mo, I mean, not only does he barely get it with his fingertips, but he has to, like, tip it back to himself to even, like, be able to grab it and then, like, rail it in.
Well, like, one photo I saw of it, like, the ball's kind of on his wrist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he, like, able to haul that thing in there, but just an incredible catch and a play that's going to go down in Georgia history as one of the greatest plays any Georgia player's ever made.
Well, it looked like you know, that we've like an Odell Beckham play.
It did. It absolutely did. And it reminded a lot of people of A.J. Green against Colorado. Granted, Georgia didn't win that game. They did win this one. But I wanted to switch to Jake Fromm now and your thoughts on his play. I thought that the coaching staff, and this is the offensive coaching staff, didn't do him a lot of favors, A, by not putting him in the best positions at times, and B, not showing faith in him in obvious passing situations. And I think as a freshman, you're probably, the wheels are turning in your brain really quickly and you're thinking about a lot of stuff. And one thing that's probably going through Fromm's head at that point is, they don't trust me to throw it here, or they don't trust me to throw it deep here. That probably caused him to start second-guessing himself. I'm not saying it did. I'm saying it's a possibility. And as a young guy like that, if you're in a hostile environment, you know, on the road, it wasn't as hostile an environment as it could have been. But still, I mean, the confidence from the coaching staff didn't seem very high in him at times.
Right. Well, I mean, I get, and maybe that's just born out of the fact he is, for the second year in a row, they're dealing with, we've got a true freshman starting at quarterback, and this one was, although as we said, I mean, it could have been in a way more hostile environment. I mean, what Fromm is going to face in 3 weeks in Knoxville is going to look different than what, assuming Eason's still out by then.
Yeah, I was going to say, if Eason's not back.
But, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a lot more hostile than what he saw Saturday night. But, you know, given that he had the two turnovers in the first half, the second one, the pick that he threw late in the first half, the defense did a good job of bailing him out there, because Notre Dame ended up with pretty good field position and then didn't even move the ball from that point. But he came back and it was clean in the second half. I mean, he did. He overthrew Godwin on that deep ball, but don't forget, I mean, Hardman dropped one too on him to sabotage him at the end. Otherwise, that's a nice long touchdown.
Yeah, if Hardman catches that ball, we're probably talking about a much more comfortable win for Georgia.
But, you know, in the end, at least what encourages me about both of those plays is, I feel like at least Georgia's offense can take shots downfield, which Georgia's offense really couldn't do last year.
And a big part of that is getting Riley Ridley back and having Ridley and Wims and those guys playing well. And look, Mecole Hardman, not necessarily a receiver by trade. I mean, they kind of had to figure out where they wanted to put him when he got to Athens, and they decided, you know, for this year that it's receiver. And if that's the case, you know, good for him, but he's got to catch the ball.
Yeah, And but I think he's going to be he's a weapon. Swift is a weapon. Of course, we know about Chubb and Michelle. There's a lot of solid pieces on that offense. But right now, from a production standpoint, it's functioning at about the same rate that it was a year ago and even the year before that. But this year, though, Georgia's got the best defense it's had in the last couple of years. And, you know, as we've seen in Gainesville the last couple of seasons, that can get you a long way, or it can at least get you to the SEC title game where Alabama ends up bludgeoning you. But
defense can certainly carry you.
Yeah, but it's been a long time since Georgia's been in Atlanta, so I'll take it. And that was a great win to win at Notre Dame.
Absolutely it was. So Georgia taking on Samford this weekend, and we're not really going to go super into that other than if Georgia has any problems with Samford, that's probably an issue.
Well, it's similar to the Appalachian State game. If people want to remind you, you know, this team last year scored 41 points at Mississippi State, and at one point it was 21-20. And I mean, I'm saying, like, yes, all that is true, but Mississippi State went 5-7 last year.
Right.
So they weren't that good. And if Georgia has a similar problem with Samford, then okay, then Georgia's not as good as we think they are. I mean, I don't think it's like we need to be worried about Samford. We need to be worried if the game is close, what that means for Georgia.
All right, we'll jump now to the Falcons, who are also in the Midwest. A lot of Georgia / Falcons fans were in the building for the Falcons against the Bears, and wasn't the greatest performance from Atlanta to start the season. Granted, it looked like Chicago's defense has gotten a lot better, but the Falcons squeak out this win.
Well, can I pat myself on the back? Now, I told you that game was going to be tough.
Oh, yeah, you did. Right. Absolutely. No, so, there's no question about
it. And the Bears covered. Wasn't easy, but they covered.
They did, barely, but they did. Or did that end at 7?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was or 6.5, so okay. I mean, it was tight.
They still got it
but
in
they,
there.
They got it. They got to the window either way.
Yeah, they certainly did, but great play by Austin Hooper. I mean, and a great play by Matt Ryan as well, because he probably could have gone down 2 or 3 times on that play and somehow scrambles his way to finding a wide-open Hooper. And people are like, well, he was wide open. It was like, yeah, but Matt Ryan still had to get away from a ton of pressure. And you could tell Schweitzer, the new right guard, was not having a great day.
No, the right side. In fact, the Falcons couldn't run the ball at all. I mean, no. Devontae Freeman averaged less than 3 yards a carry.
12 carries for 37 yards. He did get the touchdown, but not a great day for him.
And Coleman barely averaged over 3 yards a carry too. So right. They really struggled running the ball there.
But Hooper, man, when he caught that ball, and then the DBs running at him, and he just slams him to the ground with one hand on his way to the end zone.
I think a big story of this season is going to end up being, and while he was rightfully so scapegoated in the Super Bowl, the big story of the season is going to be that Atlanta really misses Kyle Shanahan.
Yeah, Sark did not look the offense didn't look nearly as fluid under Steve Sarkisian as it did under Kyle Shanahan. And hopefully Matt Ryan has a lot more to do with the offense going forward, because he's a guy that was a part of Kyle Shanahan's offense for a few years, and maybe he can maybe call some better plays. Maybe it needs to be a scenario where Sarkisian gives him a few plays and then Ryan picks the one in the huddle or picks it at the line.
Yeah, I wonder like how much, and I know it's not just Atlanta now, but I feel like years gone by, that players used to play more in the preseason. And
they
so
did.
When I think about the Falcons now, I mean, Julio Jones
played
one series.
Yeah.
Devontae Freeman ended up getting that concussion and played basically one series. He scored on the first series of the preseason in Miami, and
that was it.
Matt Ryan played, how many snaps do you estimate Matt Ryan ended up playing during the preseason?
Less than 20.
Yeah, so now you get to the first game of the season, and it's like these guys are finally, it's really the first time they're playing. They had no preseason, and you know maybe that was part of it too. But it was week one, it was on the road. The Bears, outside of their quarterback, I think are better than their record indicates.
Yeah.
And it was a good road win for Atlanta, and I mean, I didn't expect Atlanta to go there and blow them out. I said all offseason that was going to be a game that was tougher than maybe some Falcons fans wanted to think that it was going to be, but they won the game. They're 1-0, and you know I think they'll be okay as the season goes on.
I agree, and now Sunday night coming up, they've got a big game against the Packers, who had their struggles against the Seahawks, but ultimately won that game. And the Packers' defense looks a little better. At least they did against the Seahawks, although the Seahawks' offensive line looks like they need a ton of help.
Right. I mean, yeah, if I was a Packers fan, I'd be encouraged by the fact that they didn't give up a touchdown.
Right.
You know, coming off not being able to stop Atlanta in the NFC Championship game. Now, we'll see what, you know, what version of Julio Jones the Packers see Sunday night, because he torched him in the NFC title game. But when they played last year in the regular season, he had like three catches for 29 yards.
Yeah, the Falcons have a bunch of different ways they can beat you. That's a good thing about this Falcons offense is Julio Jones. Yes, he's arguably the best receiver in the NFL, but you've also got Devontae Freeman. You've also got Tevin Coleman, but the offensive line has to play a lot better. There's no question about that. That was the biggest weakness for Atlanta against Chicago.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that led to the Falcons not being able to really run the ball. You know, even last year when you look back on it, I think it was, if from memory, it was Carson Palmer, Andrew Luck was in there. I mean, Matt Ryan, I don't remember exactly where it was. Matt Ryan was in the top five last year of quarterbacks getting knocked down.
Right. And he's always been like that, it seems like.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been dealing with that his whole career.
But even last year, you're bringing in Alex Mack and what an upgrade that made and how it felt with that offense overall. I mean, the line still, they got Matt Ryan hit quite a bit last
season. They did, and that's got to be shored up. There's no doubt about that. So the Falcons did pick up the win, and that's the important thing. They went on the road in a hostile environment, got the win. Now they return home. There's going to be a lot of fanfare going on Sunday, the first ever official game at Mercedes-Benz Stadium that, you know, that isn't a preseason game, and the roof's going to be open if weather permits.
That's going to be a tough one, though, because it's you know, there's the Packers are going to be hell-bent on revenge.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, they got spanked by the Falcons in the Georgia Dome last time these two teams played, and the Falcons actually have a pretty good record against the Packers in recent years.
Right. I mean, they ended up beating them twice last year.
Yeah.
Although the one game was a one-point game, wasn't it?
Was, it,
the regular season one?
It was very close.
But
the
yeah,
Falcons had to get a goal line stand, I think, at the end, or close to a goal line stand to win.
Yeah. So, I mean, Aaron Rodgers is going to come in, and, you know, it's that NFC Championship game was basically the Packers just couldn't stop the Falcons.
No.
And the one or two times Atlanta stopped Green Bay, it was like that's when the gap started to widen there.
Exactly.
But, yeah, I mean, the Falcons' offense has to be a lot better Sunday night than it was against the Bears. Otherwise, they're going to be 1-1.
Exactly. Yeah, they're going to lose the game if they do not get better on offense. I totally agree with you there. And we'll wrap up this edition of the crossover just kind of looking around the rest of the NFL, maybe some things that we saw in Week 1. I'll go ahead and say this. I did not see that Thursday night game going down the way it did with the Chiefs pounding on the Patriots like that.
I had to put New England. I didn't put them in my bottom five this week, but I did give them an honorable mention. I mean, that was the third worst home loss an NFL team had. The Texans were one. Then there were two teams, the Niners and the Bengals, that lost at home by 20. And then number three was a 15-point loss at home by the Patriots. So I gave them honorable mention.
Yeah, they made Alex Smith look like Joe Montana out there. I mean, 368 yards passing, four touchdowns. How about rookie Kareem Hunt, 148 yards on the ground. Tyreek Hill, also seven catches for a 133 and a touchdown. The Chiefs might be legit. You know, I mean, they've always been a good team with Alex Smith at quarterback, but maybe they figured something out with him.
Well, the or maybe he figured, he's like, man, they moved up to the number 10 spot to draft a quarterback. That guy ain't starting. So he came. But, yeah, I mean, Kansas City, since Andy Reid has gotten there, have been good. They keep making the playoffs. But, you know, Eagles fans are probably warning Chiefs fans, don't get too excited, because once the playoffs come, you'll end up wilting. The team I think that's in trouble, you know, has a Week 1 overreaction, though. Talk about the numbers that quarterbacks did, but the New Orleans Saints.
Ooh.
What Sam Bradford did to them on Monday night. And when you're the Saints, you think about, all right, we're in a division where we have to face the last two NFL MVPs and Jameis Winston six times.
Yeah.
And if Sam Bradford goes 27 for 32 for, like, what was it, 350 yards or something?
346.
Yeah. I mean, the Saints are – that's big trouble. That's bad defense.
No doubt about that. Also, a team that looked really bad, the Bengals, losing 20-0 to the Ravens. And that sets up just a wonderful Thursday night matchup this week between the Bengals and the Texans, although Deshaun Watson will be making his first career start. So basically, Deshaun Watson didn't start a half of a game of this season for the Texans before they put him in the second half, and now he's going to be the starter for them. But yes, a team that lost 29-7 to the Jaguars is taking on a team that didn't score any points against the Ravens.
Right, so and both of those results were after having a full time to prepare for those games.
Right.
And both teams were at home with ample time to get ready for it, combined to score one touchdown. Now on a short week, they're going to play. And then one of those teams is starting a rookie quarterback on a short week.
And one of these teams has to win. Andy Dalton, by the way, 170 yards passing, four picks.
Yeah, that's why that total Thursday night is 38.
You think the armor is finally starting to crack a little bit for Marvin Lewis? This might be the end.
Maybe. But speaking of teams that had it have it rough, how about my fantasy football team where my two quarterbacks are Andy Dalton and Eli Manning?
Oh, brave.
Those two teams combined to score 3 points Sunday.
I don't think we can really go anywhere else with the crossover today other than just ending on that sad, sad note. So for Chris Brame, I'm Sam Franco. We'll be back next week with another exciting edition of the Crossover Podcast right here on 960theref.com.
You've been listening to the Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brame on 960theref.com.